Welcome to Cross Defense on this Monday, January the 27th, 2014. Where did the month of January go? I think with the cold air, that's what I think, or the warm air. Welcome in to this unique program where we do apologetics for inquiring minds of all ages. And if you're interested in apologetics, you're going to be interested in this show. Today we have a fascinating topic to talk about, and it's a difficult one, the incarnation of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Well, if you don't know what that word means, you'll hopefully find that out and much more in this time together. And this is a call-in listener participation show. If you're listening anywhere around the world, you can call in with your comments or your questions for our guest. Worldwide, 800-730-2727, or in the St. Louis listening area, 314-821-0850, or you can email us at kfuo@kfuo.org. Our guest today is a pastor in Southern California, and I don't know, Mark, have you achieved your doctorate or not? Can we call you doctor yet?
You can, but it won't be true. Not yet. As Brian Wolfmuller calls me, almost Dr. Pearson. But
doctor in waiting, then.
Yeah, Pastor Pearson, Mark Pearson, just Mark is fine.
And are you ministering anywhere at the present right now, Mark?
Yes, I'm assistant pastor at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Long Beach, California.
Great. Love the Long Beach area. I know you have quite the background and the interest and the education in apologetics, and so that's going to be really put to the test today because incarnation is a difficult topic, isn't it? Let's begin with this for those out there that might not understand that word real well. Tell us what the incarnation is all about.
Well, the term itself, it just means in the flesh or the enfleshment of God. And so we're always referring to Jesus with the incarnation because Christians of all stripes believe that Jesus, the historical figure who lived 2,000 years ago, is in fact God himself who has appeared as a human being. He has taken on human flesh. He is still God as a human, but nonetheless the one who created all things, the unmoved mover, he took on human flesh such that he is a full-fledged human being in every single way that we are, except without sin. In essence, the incarnation is God becoming man.
Or, you know, we could even go with the word itself, incarnation, where we see the word carnal. So it really means God in a human body, right? God in a human body.
Yeah, God in the flesh.
Yeah, God in the flesh. So amazing thing that, you know, when I hear that even today, Mark, it just blows my mind. I do not understand it, but the more I learn about it and its relevance and its meaning for us human beings on planet Earth, it's marvelous. So let's begin with something. I saw this Facebook post, I think it was in the Christmas season, and I really liked it, so I thought we'd start with this, because I think it will take us, hopefully, in directions that we really want to talk about in regards to the incarnation. It is more important and relevant that God walked on the earth with us than a man walked on the moon. You know, now, I'm of that generation, Mark, probably a little bit more years than you. I can remember distinctly where I was when we landed the first human being on the moon. I can tell you the house, we didn't have a color TV. They just came into being. And so we went over to some friends who had a big color TV. I think it was all about 15 inches. And it seems kind of small these days. But we watched this human being walk on the moon for the first time. And, you know, as great and as relevant as that is, far more meaningful and relevant that God himself walked here on this planet.
Oh, certainly. And I'm a Gen Xer, and I was born after that event, so I can only imagine and relive it through conversations and movies. But as awestruck as people were that that actually happened, I mean, far more important is that God himself walked on the earth. Well, I'm walking on the moon at the time, you know, the Cold War, it's us versus the Russians. Kennedy makes the promise, we're going to get there by the end of the decade, and we do it, and go USA. But really, what ultimate significance is there in that? Everybody is still going to die. Everybody still has their sins. So it's a great accomplishment for man, but it doesn't really help anybody in the eternal sense.
Furthermore, some people today, Mark, even challenge that that never happened in reality, that they did it in a studio somewhere, in a TV studio. They made it up to look like a moonscape. And we factually, historically, never did venture out there that far in space to the moon, that it was all made up. And some people believe that about the incarnation of Jesus, don't they?
Well, they certainly do. For whatever reason, in our society right now, conspiracy theories are all the rage. And so landing on the moon, who really brought down the Twin Towers on 9/11? You name it, who killed President Kennedy? Are there really aliens? Is there an Area 51 with a UFO in a hangar somewhere? People really like conspiracy theories, and most popular of all seems to be the one about Jesus. It's kind of not the hot-button issue it was a few years ago, but, that was the Da Vinci Code's whole thing. It just said, the whole Jesus thing is a conspiracy, made up by powerful bureaucrats in the church and in the empire about 300 years after Jesus. And all the Christians have been so dumb since then, they don't really realize that it's just a fairy tale used for political power.
Now, one of the things that, as I get older, Mark, and I'm sure you're into this, I'm going to take a wild stab out there and say you're interested in this too, is history. Because what's happened in the past, if it is really, of significance and interest, there should be a historical trail, some evidence left behind that we as rational and intelligent people, we can look at and examine that evidence and cross-examine it to whether what they're telling us about this event, like landing on the moon, or that Jesus was really a historical figure that ever really walked here, happened. And that's really what, apologetics really gets into in our brand, I believe, evidentiary apologetics, really gets into historical evidence. And so is there any historical evidence at all that Jesus was on this planet?
Oh, certainly. You covered a lot there in that intro to what I'm about to say. So I don't know how much, we have an hour, so I guess we can hash this all out. But for the basic question, is there any evidence that Jesus actually lived? Yes, actually there's more evidence for Jesus than any figure from the ancient world in terms of written documentation. We have, within 100 years of Christ, we have over 30 documents referencing him as an actual real person. You don't have that for anybody else in the ancient world, not for Julius Caesar, not for Alexander the Great, not for Marcus Aurelius. So it is really, you're hard-pressed to say that there was no Jesus, that he himself, in any way, shape, or form, never existed. In fact, I don't know of a single historian, trained historian, who's willing to say that. There might be one or two, but then again, that would be one or two out of tens of thousands of trained historians in the world. You're really hard-pressed.
And Mark, I think what you were commenting on there is really important for the listeners to hear and understand. You said, I believe, within 100 years. And so what's the important significance close proximity in time that we have historical writings of a person being around and what they did, what happened to them, etc.?
That's a very important question. I'm glad you raised that. Historians operate simply thinking the closer we get back to the events in question, more likely, the more reliable the reports are going to be. I'm very thankful we don't have just one gospel on Jesus, we have four, but again, we have multiple documents in addition to that. If all of our sources on Jesus were from, say, the 700s, then I would think we have a problem. Most historians would say that's not really that reliable. Like, for instance, take the figure Buddha, the what seems to be the historical figure Siddhartha Gautama. Our earliest manuscript that refers to him as a historical person, as far as I know, is about 500 years after he supposedly lived. And so historians don't really treat that as a definitely reliable source. But if you look at Jesus, we're in much better categories there.
Well, what would be the danger, the problems with, let's say, that one that you brought up, 500 years after the person was existing, then to talk about his life? What would be problematic about that?
Well, you don't have a paper trail, meaning people could just insert things at any given point in the narrative, and you have no way of checking if it's reliable or not. It could have been written simply 500 years later by someone who made it up, or it could have been something that started and then kind of had a snowball effect, and everyone added another story they thought was kind of nice and cute. But you don't have things going back to those who experienced Jesus, or in that case, Buddha, firsthand. What we really want is eyewitness testimony, people who knew Jesus, who saw Jesus, or at least knew those who did know and see Jesus. Once you get beyond, say, that level, you're starting to get into the telephone game, the old game that you probably played as a kid where you whisper someone in someone's ear, and by the time it goes around the room, what that person says probably doesn't match too well what the initial thing said.
Yeah, it's changed. It's been embellished. We could say it's kind of analogous, could we not, to someone, let's say, 20 years from this point saying, hey, back in 2014, Pastor Rod Zwanitzer was the director of KFUO, the station of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in St. Louis. And the people would still be around, hopefully, by that 20 years that would know, I was the director. And they could even give some evidence that proved it. So I think that's what you're saying, are you not, Mark, that there would be a closer you get to when Jesus was around. Then I think in what you're describing, and you might even give us a couple examples of this, we have people who were taught by Jesus' own eyewitnesses, the apostles, who claim, I was around these people who were the eyewitnesses of our Lord. And that's pretty valuable historical evidence, isn't it?
Yeah, it actually doesn't get better than that. If you're in a court case, the eyewitness was there. You were not there. You got all your information secondhand. But the eyewitness, that person's testimony is the most authoritative because he or she has inside information, as it were. I remember a few years ago, a movie came out called The Hurricane, where with Denzel Washington, and I actually never saw the movie. I think he was a boxer or something. But I think it was based on a true story. And I remember people were critiquing it because it wasn't accurate. And this was printed up in the LA Times. I remember seeing it. And I think it was the director, said, next time I'm going to make a movie about Julius Caesar because no one's around to tell me that I got it wrong. And I thought that was a really poignant point that if everybody who knew the person in question is dead and gone, you can kind of get away with saying what you want. But if there are eyewitnesses still present, you can't because they're going to correct you.
That's a very good point. And, the people that really specialize in this, And historians, I know, they work with what we call primary sources, primary documents, which is sometimes written by the very person themselves or eyewitnesses' accounts, and then secondary. And, next week I have to go to report for jury duty, and I think it was about 6 years ago I had my first time on jury, and it was an important case. It was a double attempted murder, a double attempted kidnap with a felon gun charge and everything. So pretty serious. And there were two different stories of the history that happened months before that. And, as the trier of fact that we were interested in the witnesses, let's say that, I remember one of them was a relative of the defendant. And we were wondering, how much do we weigh their side of the story? Because they have a legitimate interest in not seeing their loved one go to incarceration for this. And so, and then others where we learned they had no horse in the race, so to speak. They were just there and could give testimony to what they saw, what they heard, and how the event developed. And that's kind of like that with Jesus, you were saying too, isn't it? With these eyewitnesses who had no really reason to embellish or make it up, like some would say, because their fate kind of spoke against that. So maybe you talked a little bit about to us, because I know you have interest in that, working in the New Testament, that we have this link, we have this trail, as you were talking about, of eyewitnesses and then the people that went on and recorded this, that's very firm, pretty good historical evidence.
We do. And in fact, before I forget to mention it, the best book out there on us right now is called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by Richard Balcom. And he is a very well-respected scholar, and his research is always meticulous. And he goes through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and evaluates and investigates whether or not they are accurate eyewitness sources. And he ends up concluding yes. But it's interesting because other New Testament scholars, like Richard Balcom, will read his work and more or less say, well, even though I don't personally believe in Jesus, I can't say that he got it wrong, which is really telling, I think. Now, you mentioned this court case about the person being a relative. One thing that people tend to do, and I usually try to point out that they're doing this, is they will dismiss the New Testament documents because they're written from a bias. There's a biased position because they believe in Jesus, so of course they're going to make him appear as the Son of God, as the Savior of the world, as the risen Christ, or something like that. Well, I like to point out, everyone has a bias, though. So you have a bias when you're saying that. So really, bias just gets you to a stalemate. No one can write without bias. It's really impossible. But to dismiss people simply because of bias is also irresponsible. But then I will point out, you know, read the Gospels. How do the disciples come across in the Gospels? They more often than not come across as confused or even trying to deter Jesus from his mission. They don't come across as great guys who always got it. I mean, at one point, Jesus calls Peter, the head of the disciples, he calls him Satan. Now, after the fact, if you're Peter and you want people to believe you and follow what you're teaching about Jesus, you might leave that story out. You don't want to say, oh, by the way, I'm the head of this gang, and Jesus picked me to feed his sheep. He also said, though, that I was equivalent to the devil because I didn't really want him to go get crucified.
Or you could add, you know, pile on to that, Mark, that, you know, when he could come to Jesus' defense, he denies him three times, you know. So there's a lot of that. That's very good because, and I love what you were saying about no matter what position you take on something historical, like Jesus being here on this planet as a historical person, you have a bias. And so we all go into it with bias, and we should admit that. And you know, that Richard Balcom book you mentioned, that is just fantastic. I love that. And then there's another one I'm sure you're familiar with, that Larry Hurtado has a book on a similar subject, saying that, boy, these people back then, even outside of the Bible, were great historians. And there's a lot of really good stuff, you know, penned about Jesus in that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're just to return to the problem of bias. One thing to point out also is that not everyone who came to believe in Jesus and even who wrote from the New Testament was initially a disciple and believed in Jesus all along. You have James, the brother of Jesus, was a skeptic, didn't even believe in his own brother until after the resurrection. You have Paul, who tried to snuff out Christianity, writing about half of the New Testament. So these are not things written by lifelong Christians by any means. Some of them are skeptics to begin with. They don't believe in Jesus. They want to stop the whole movement, and then they convert. So it's not just a bunch of people getting together in a dark room saying, hey, how can we come up with the biggest fraud of all time? You actually have people who are against it from the start who then end up getting on board because they are convinced by the evidence.
Wow. I'm thinking even, too, one of my favorite portions of the Bible, Luke 24, a record of that first Easter day. You know, two disciples are walking to Emmaus, and Jesus appears to them, and they don't even understand the significance of what's going on, the history. And so the Bible seems, as you're pointing out here, Mark, seems to not be of that sort, would we say, that's all one-sided. It has kind of a a chronology, a movement of skeptics and non-believers and even people that were in opposition to our Lord and what he was trying to do for quite a while.
Right. There's more diversity in the New Testament than people usually assume. Again, I think it's because they think all the disciples had each other on speed dial and just got together and concocted the story. But you find that there are problems. I mean, why do you have, for example, in Acts chapter 15, why do you have a council of Jerusalem where the apostles have to get together to have a discussion about what do we do with all these Gentiles converting? If you're just making it all up, I mean, it seems to me you could just say, oh, well, Jesus said we should do this. Because if the whole thing is fabricated anyways, why not just willy-nilly, out of thin air, create more sayings of Jesus that handle the problem you're currently dealing with decades later? But they don't do that. They sit down and they discuss, okay, how do we handle this issue? And they walk through it instead of just making things up, because that's what they've been doing all along.
We're needed to go to a break here in a little bit, but before we do, I thought this might be a good time to maybe hook up with something that I thought we could make some hay to talk about. One of my favorite apologists, and maybe yours too, Mark, John Warwick Montgomery, he argues that the Christian doctrine of the incarnation that we're talking about on today's show, that God comes in the flesh in a human body, it repudiates any attempt to divorce a Christian factual history from secular non-religion history and facts. I really like that. Could you comment on that a little bit before we go on a break, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Montgomery is a master at this, and really it's just saying, look, yes, this is a religious claim or a theological claim, but it's not divorced from the real world. The central claim of Christianity is essentially that a real guy did real things at a particular place at a particular time. We're not speculating about God and gods and the afterlife and angels and demons and spirits. We are getting to the root of Christianity by looking at the flesh and blood person of history, Jesus of Nazareth. And no other religion on the planet can make a claim even remotely close to that. That sets Christianity off into a category of one.
Well, I like how you said that. And that is really testable, too, isn't it? I mean, what you're talking about here and Dr. Montgomery and others talk about as Christianity being a very accurate, truthful, historical-based religion, faith system, is unlike any others. I mean, and you started off that way, I believe, by talking about how reliable it is in antiquity of its time. Nothing else even comes close to it. And I know there's people that have actually went out there and tested that. I'm thinking of the guy who wrote the book, Frank Morrison, who moved the stone that set out to factually disprove a lot of the historical fact. And when he went out and started looking at the sources that you and Dr. Montgomery look at as apologists, he was very convinced of its factuality.
Oh, sure. This happens time and again. You have skeptics who actually are willing to do a historical investigation, and they end up changing their mind. Now, not everyone does, and I think we might be able to get into this, but one of the reasons is because of their own presuppositions about the supernatural not actually crossing over with history. But usually when you look at converts to Christianity who are thoughtful and honest and do the research, you find the evidence is what compels them. As opposed to, look at the books written by the defectors from those who have left the faith. It's usually not because the evidence they found to be wanting. It's because of some other personal or psychological reason. I couldn't understand why God, if he's so loving, let my parents die in a car crash.
Let's pick that up right there. That music says we have to go to break, and let's pick it up right there, Mark, when we come back. Stick with us on Cross Defense.
Yeah. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, inviting you to join us for Issues Etc. weekday afternoons from 3 to 5. Issues Etc. is a live call-in show with a twofold purpose. First, we defend and teach the truths rediscovered during the Reformation, grace, faith, scripture, and Christ alone. Second, we challenge today's postmodern culture with its unbiblical ideology.
Issues Etc. live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO Radio.
Serving seniors wherever they call home. That's Lutheran Senior Services Home Health. For those who need to regain independence after an injury, illness, or decline in health or ability, Lutheran Senior Services Home Health can arrange for a variety of skilled services that will help older adults recover where they feel most comfortable, at home. Doctor's referral required, Medicare certified. Lutheran Senior Services Home Health. Learn more at lssliving.org.
Author Tim Gagline, who served as the special assistant to President George W. Bush, talks about the importance of KFUO.
KFUO is in the middle of the culture, and if you want to impact culture, you have to be in it. I think that we owe the best that is within us to our country, culture, and civilization. And now with the advent of the internet to the world, how do we find new ways to the rising generation of young Americans to share the good news of Jesus' birth, death, and resurrection? How do we use our moral imagination? How do we use creativity to get the word out? That's what it's all about. That's what KFUO is doing. It is making it new. It's saying, here is our great legacy and our great heritage as Lutherans who are privileged and honored to live in this country. I love KFUO for that reason.
On the radio, online, and on demand, worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Following a sellout event last year, Grace Place Lutheran Wellness Ministries will hold its fourth annual Soup for the Soul fundraiser Sunday, February 16th, 4 to 7 p.m. at St. John Church in Ellisville. Enjoy soups, breads, and desserts from over 20 of St. Louis's premier restaurants at this family-friendly event. Tickets are available online at graceplacewellness.org, by calling the office at 314-842-3077, or at the door.
Have you ever missed a live broadcast of one of your favorite KFUO programs? Well, let me propose a convenient solution for you. Visit the KFUO website, kfuo.org, and download your favorite program by way of podcast to your iPhone or other smart device. It's easy, it's simple, it's convenient, and you'll never miss another program. KFUO, the official voice of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is the messenger of good news by way of radio, web, and podcast.
Gospel artists are the big winners in the Christian music categories at this year's Grammy Awards.
Woo! Glory to God forever. I want to thank
Ty Tribbett won two Grammys for Best Gospel Song and Best Gospel Album. Tasha Cobbs won the Grammy for Best Gospel Contemporary Christian Music Performance. In her acceptance speech, Cobbs shared that
7 days ago today, I had just celebrated an amazing day in my life, and my father was there with me. And the next day, he went on to be with his Jesus. So this is solely dedicated to my father.
Ty Tribbett asked the audience to
pray comfort to her family as well. Let's continue.
Mandisa won the Grammy Award for Best Contemporary Christian Music Album, and its title song, Overcomer, took the Grammy for Best Contemporary Christian Music Song. I'm Steve Coleman.
Thanks for sticking with us here on Cross Defense. Apologetics, making a defense of the hope that we Christians have, and always supposed to be prepared to do that, according to 2 Peter 3. That's what we attempt to do in this show, apologetics for inquiring minds of all ages. Today we have Pastor Mark Pearson from California, and we're talking about a tough subject, the incarnation. Mark, I had to rudely interrupt you there with the break music, and you were saying some great stuff. Let's pick it up right there if we can.
Sure. Before I was rudely interrupted, just kidding. I was getting to the point that when people do a serious historical investigation of our sources about Jesus, very often that is what convinces them that the thing is true based on the evidence. But for those who leave Christianity, most of the time it's not because of the lack of evidence. It's for something else. As I was getting to, some tragedy might happen in someone's life. Now, that is a very real apologetic issue, but it is about the problem of evil and how do we reconcile evil, pain, and suffering in the world with a loving God. But that doesn't have to do with, directly, the evidence for Jesus. And so most people who leave the Christian faith will then, after they've had an awful experience or something to that effect, that colors how they're willing to deal with the evidence. The easiest example here is Bart Ehrman. He publishes quite a bit, and most of his books now are all about saying how Christianity is false, and he knows because he used to be one. But as a New Testament scholar, he will try to say that the text is full of holes, there's not historical enough evidence to believe what Christians believe, but then you read enough of him, and it comes out that none of his studies in New Testament work is what made him leave Christianity. It was because he couldn't deal with the problem of evil. So really, he's publishing, say, two books a year now, bashing Christianity for reasons that he will even admit aren't what made him leave Christianity. It's something else entirely.
Mark, are you saying here that it's important when we're discussing with someone about an apologetic topic like, did Christ really exist as a historical person in this world, that we understand their bias, their presuppositions that they bring to the discussion? Like you were saying, that I can easily see how in somebody's life experience there might be some engagement with Christianity or other religion that forms a bias, a disposition, a presuppositions that they bring to the table that maybe are going to color their view of the evidence.
Sure, and that is really our current climate. Many people start from the viewpoint of no one can really know what's true, or Jesus is one version of the truth, and that's true for you, but Krishna or Buddha or Muhammad or whatever, that is for me or for everyone else. You have no claim to absolute truth. And along with that will be the presupposition that, well, I know that miracles can't happen. And so it doesn't matter what historical evidence you present. In their mind, walking on water, changing water into wine, rising from the dead, that is inadmissible and unacceptable because that's not history. Now, of course, you can probe further and say, well, how did you come to that conclusion? What is it that makes you think that supernatural events cannot be investigated as in the same way as simply natural events? And I've never heard a good answer on that. But if that's their starting point, then there's no amount of evidence that will convince them. And I point out, then it's not really about the evidence, is it? It's about what you have presupposed to be the case, and your presupposition rests on very little, if not nothing.
Right, and that's a vital point that that you're making here, and so we need to be aware of that. If we might, unless you have more on this trajectory that we were going, I'd like to shift it a little bit, talking about the incarnation of God, with a comment that I really liked. And so hopefully you'll like it too, and if not, we can go in another direction. One of my favorite Christian writers, and I've had the opportunity to interview him a couple of times here on KFUO, Dr. Alistair McGrath, in a Times London article that he wrote, he titled it and then talked about this, "The Incarnation is the Thawing of Our Wintry World." Because, you know, Dr. McGrath, he's really into C.S. Lewis. And he sees a lot of Lewis's life in his own, coming from Ireland, teaching at Oxford, kind of being an academic, both of them atheists, and then becoming Christians. And so he's playing on this idea in The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, where there's this thought that, you know, when Jesus comes into planet Earth, there's a change from then on that's never been there before. What do you think of that, Mark?
I think both McGrath and Lewis are right on. And, you know, in that article, McGrath talks about how, for Lewis, simply belief in God changed the way he saw things. It helped with imagination, making sense of the world. But he really had trouble with Jesus. Like, okay, so God exists. That does change things. but what do we make of this man from Nazareth? And then he came to realize that Christianity isn't just a set of propositions. It's not just a book on systematic theology. More importantly, it is basically a story. It is a story about how God entered our reality to save us from what we could not save ourselves. It's this grand narrative. And because it's God entering our story, that means it is historical, as we just talked about. One of Lewis's dear friends, Tolkien, said that the incarnation is the eucatastrophe of man's story, and the resurrection is the eucatastrophe of the incarnation. Mm. Eucatastrophe was a word that Tolkien used to explain there's a turn or a twist that is so powerful within a story. It creates so much joy, it almost feels like pain. It's so overwhelming. And Tolkien talked about how the story of man is a horrible story. Bloodshed, killing, betrayal, and then the incarnation happens. And it's so marvelous that God has chosen to become a human being to save our fallen race. And then within that own story of the incarnation, the Christ dies. And yet he rises from the dead. So you go, there are levels here of what's going on. The incarnation is not just that God showed up in human flesh, but he did so to redeem us. We never want to separate the incarnation from redemption won by Christ on the cross.
I like what you did with that, Mark, very much, because what you were describing there is what C.S. Lewis and McGrath, and I think you and I would describe too. And correct me if I'm wrong, but when you're talking about bias, looking at the evidence for Jesus in the incarnation, McGrath isn't saying that when I first started considering the evidence for Christianity, it you know, destroyed my bias. He's saying, no, it began to show me a big story, a meta-narrative, a different way to look at myself, the world, and everything. And so I'm going to consider that carefully. And I know C.S. Lewis and McGrath did that as well. And that's a great approach, isn't it, to even defending Jesus here. And I know McGrath talks about this, just introduce people to the man Jesus and see what happens. Because the Bible, as you know, in the New Testament especially, tends to view the universe and the world and the problems that we have, including evil and suffering and temptations, in a totally different way, in a totally different perspective than is normally taken. And I like what you were talking about there. It's not a set of propositional truths, although those are there too, but it's looking at this whole another perspective on everything through the eyes of Christ.
Yeah, exactly. Christianity is a worldview, and everyone has a worldview. This is how people try to make sense of the world. I mean, we are meaning-making machines, just as human beings. Secularists would agree with that. We try to figure out what's going on around us, and we construct narratives or ideas to make sense of everything. Well, in the marketplace of religious ideas, there are lots of worldviews, but which one is not only coherent? Coherence is important. But which one is true, and can you know that truth objectively? And as I said before, that's where Christianity is really in a category all by itself. Luther said that when you want to talk about God, don't start with speculation. Speculative theology gets you nowhere. You don't want to start at the top in heaven with God the Father.
Give us an example of speculative theology, if you would, Mark.
I'll use the religion of Islam, because when I talk to Muslims, and I get into this sort of thing apologetically, virtually every time, not every time, but virtually every time, the Muslim wants to start by defining God. God is one, and therefore he cannot be one in three, he must be one. Therefore he cannot have an equal, he cannot have a son. If God is one, then Christianity is out.
So you assume going in that you speculate this has to be the way that God is, rather than look at it from another angle, another perspective.
Right. And very similarly, it'll be God cannot change, because if you're perfect, you're unchangeable. Therefore, God cannot become a human being, and certainly God cannot die. Well, I would say, you know, for those of you who remember your logic from maybe college or high school, that might be a valid argument, but it's not necessarily true. If your premise is correct, then okay, but why should I start with that premise or with that presupposition? Why should I start with God being one cannot also exist as separate persons? Why should I start with God cannot change, which means he can't also become a human and die? There's no reason to. You're speculating that that's where we're supposed to start. I understand it seems logical to you, but why should I get on board with the speculations that you start with?
Well, yeah, why is that starting point the absolute only one that could ever be? You'd have to prove that one to even begin at that point, I think is what you're saying.
Right. And, you know, Montgomery has this great example. He says, you know, when you're dating a girl and you want to introduce her to your parents, first, of course, you're going to tell your parents about this girl and how great she is. You say that she's tall and has brown hair and blue eyes, and she's really pretty and really funny and really smart. And they get kind of an idea of who this person is. But the absolute best way to let someone know who this one is to have them show up. And then you can point to that girl, to your parents, and say, there she is. And then they will get to see exactly who she is for themselves. And the comparison he does there is, all religions will speculate about God, a higher power, a force, fate with a capital F, something like that. That really gets us nowhere, though. If you want to know who God really is, look to the man Jesus Christ. That is your definition of God.
Well said. We've got about 15 minutes left, so if you'd like to call in with a question for Pastor Pearson or a comment, you can do so in the St. Louis listening area, 314-821-0850, worldwide, 800-730-2727, or you can email us, kfuo@kfuo.org. Mark, you're taking us down some very good lines here. Let's maybe do this, though. A person might say, okay, Pastor Pearson, I'm going to, for the moment, for the purpose of just discussing this with you, I'm going to allow that Jesus was really a historical person. But what evidence is there that he's really a God and really human at the same time?
Oh, well, that's a good question. And in fact, in doing evangelism, I've learned that you really want to avoid rabbit trails, because people want to talk about all sorts of things, like Jonah being swallowed by the great fish, or Moses parting the Red Sea, and even with Jesus, it'll be focusing on individual miracles while leaving aside the ultimate miracle of the resurrection. The best evidence and proof that Jesus is who he claimed to be is his own resurrection from the dead. I would say go there, focus all your efforts there, because if you get that, you get the whole thing. You're kind of wasting your time if you do otherwise.
And as well, Mark, could we say that the New Testament says that is true? That's a linchpin. If you If you could disprove the resurrection historically happened, we've lost it all.
Sure, and I'll say this to people: you know, if Jesus actually rose from the dead, what would that mean? And usually the response is, but he didn't rise from the dead. And I say, okay, I know you don't believe it, but if he actually, truly, physically rose from the dead, what would that mean? And again, the answer is usually, but he didn't. And I say, okay, calm down. but very often they'll pause and they'll think about it and they'll say, well, I guess that would mean it's true. And I say, right. Now let's flip it. If Jesus really didn't rise from the dead, what would that mean? It would mean it's false. And that comes from the New Testament. And in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul makes it very clear. He says, if Christ has not been raised from the dead, then our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. The whole thing is game over if on Easter Sunday we have a dead Jesus. And we as Christians should not be afraid to admit that. That's in our text. That's what it all comes down to. Is he alive or is he dead? How do you know? Well, investigate the evidence and see what you get.
So if this resurrection really happened, the incarnation really happened. I think that's the tie you're making, and that's a fantastic tie. Because, and let's ask this question then, Mark. Is there historical evidence to the resurrection?
Indeed. And remember that this is the resurrection is recorded in texts. So we always want to start with, are these gospels reliable records of history? We don't need to ask the non-Christian to get on board and say it's inspired, inerrant, the word of God, infallible, holy, anything like that. These are ancient biographies about an ancient figure. Let's look at them like we would look at any ancient biography about an ancient figure. It does so happen that in these, they record that this central figure, Jesus, rose from the dead, but if we're simply going to look at whether or not it happened based on the evidence, we need to let the evidence convince us either way.
So all of this is just with this open mind and aware of our own bias, we look at the evidence that's out there. And there's a lot of it to consider.
There is, and it's not just the text. I mean, we have, you know, when people do this sort of thing, it is text that's really important, but there are also tangible artifacts included in that would be the tomb. You can go over there and see the tomb where Jesus was placed. You can see Calvary. I mean, these things are still there. So you also want to think about, and this is what people do in court cases, what explanation takes into account all the evidence and makes the most sense. So if you say, oh, but he didn't really rise from the dead, you have some things to explain. How do you get, and you were mentioning this earlier, how do you get these disciples who are willing to give up everything to proclaim that Jesus really did rise from the dead when they were all brutally put to death for it, or almost all?
Yeah, that makes no sense to me. That makes no sense.
Motive is taken into account. Why would they do this? They didn't get rich. They didn't get famous. They died brutal deaths. And if they made it up, they know it's not true. So from their perspective as Jews, they're misleading everyone about who the Messiah is. That means they're going to hell. So why would they do it? Now, there are instances where people are really convinced of something. You know, it was false, but I really thought it was true, so I'm going along with it. But in the case of Jesus' resurrection, these guys would have had to steal the body, though, for that to work. So it's not like they were misled. It's that, no, they were nefarious. They were deceptive, and they stole dead Jesus and then concocted this story to convince the world of a lie. That just doesn't work. Like, that would not hold up in court.
Yeah, that kind of an explanation of the historical evidence just doesn't make sense to me. You know, I refer back to that jury trial that I was on. You know, that's what the defense tried to do is tell us a different story that they ask us to, you know, comport with the facts. And I remember there was one piece of evidence they put forward, and the district attorney then said, okay, look at this other one that I've already entered into and the defense accepted as true. Consider the evidence. And we looked at it and we said, okay, we know who's telling us the truth here. Because of that, given that we all said, even the defense, their story did not comport. It did not match up. I like what
right.
you're saying is which meta-narrative, you know, comports, matches up with the best with the historical evidence that's out there. And so when we look at the resurrection and the eyewitnesses in that, it's pretty convincing when you look at all of it.
It is. And for the people who come up with a different narrative, a different scenario, they always end up having to dismiss the evidence. But the evidence is what you're supposed to base your scenario on. For example, there's a New Testament scholar, John Dominic Crossan. He says, well, Jesus died as a criminal, and what the Romans always did with criminals is they threw the bodies into common graves, and so then the dead bodies were just picked apart by wild dogs and vultures and things like that. And I would say, okay, but the very reason you even think Jesus was crucified is because you're going by what the texts say. So you're agreeing with the text here, but you're dismissing the text over here based on what? Based on not much. Or people will come up with different scenarios of, oh, Jesus had a twin that no one knew about until the day of Easter, and that was Jesus' twin that everyone saw. Or even a few years ago, the BBC did a special called Did Jesus Really Die? And they said, no. And this is an old theory. This is called the swoon theory, you might be familiar with.
Sure.
But the reason people thought Jesus rose from the dead was because he passed out on the cross and then revived in the tomb, and everyone said, oh, you were dead and now you're alive. And every once in a while, you'll hear in the news some story about someone who was pronounced dead by the doctors and then who actually was alive the day later or something like that. And they say, yeah, that's what happened with Jesus. It's not a resurrection. It's a recitation. Well, the problem, again, is the evidence. you have Jesus being pronounced dead by Roman soldiers, stabbed in the heart just to make sure. There's only one instance, I think there's only one instance that we know of where anyone was ever taken down from a crucifixion, and that guy, or taken down while still alive, and that guy lasted another day, and yet he still died. I mean, what happened to Jesus was so brutal, there's no way he would have survived that. But if you want to come up with an alternate theory, again, you just have to dismiss the hard evidence.
Yeah, that explanation just does not match up with the evidence. It's almost like obvious that someone is trying to misinterpret the evidence. I remember, like in the jury case I was telling you about, the wild explanation they were giving us was that the gun that was used in this attempted murder and kidnapping was inside the car before the defendant ever approached. And so they ask, okay, where was the gun? And he said, well, it was in the kind of the holding portion of the door. And the district attorney showed us a picture of that model of a Chevy, and it had no such door container on it. And we're all like, okay, that doesn't work with the evidence. And I think that's what you're saying here, Mark, that a lot of those things just do not match up with the record. And I was going to say, as we're running out of time, I just got a great new book that you contributed an essay in, Making the Case for Christianity, Modern Objections, I believe, to the faith or to the Bible. And you contributed, I believe, one on the reliability of the New Testament documents or something like that. Is that right?
Yeah, this book was Adam Francisco and Corey Moss. This is their brainchild. And it's I'm not just saying this because I contributed to it, but it's really helpful because it actually has a logical progression, and it goes through the existence of God, the documents, that's my chapter, the resurrection, and then it also hits some of the big issues. And so really it's kind of a handbook, not in the sense that it's, if someone says this, then say this back, but it's a very good introduction to some of the more popular apologetic issues that come up. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say why I mentioned that, because I haven't read it all, but I've read a lot, and it's just fantastic. And I'm thinking that a lot of what's in there really applies to what we're talking about today, does it not?
Oh, sure. In fact, I would say every chapter in there is really either directly discussing the incarnation, or the incarnation is on the sidelines and they're all being built upon the incarnation. As you mentioned before, evidentiary, an evidential view, everything deals with the incarnation. So the problem of evil, the existence of God, things like that. Ultimately, for the Christian, it comes down to the incarnation.
Sure. The Scandal of Particularity, I've read that one. That's great. And we're going to have Dr. Francisco on here pretty quick, hopefully, to talk about this book. And so I urge the listeners out there that are interested in what Pastor Pearson has been talking about today, they can check out a couple of those chapters in that book. It's really good. So, Mark, we've really enjoyed having you on today. It was not an easy topic, but I like where you took us, the resurrection. That is a firmly placed, firmly entrenched historical test, apologetic test. And I know you in that book, too, there's some great references where people interested can go and have more. Any quick little thing, about 30 seconds, you want to say about what we discussed today?
Just as a follow-up, as a closing thought, everything we talk about today has to do with appealing to people's reason. And I'm all for it. That's what apologetics does. It presents evidence. It lets people decide based on what they think. You don't take a blind faith. But there's a distinction. There's a distinction between believing that Jesus was a real person who died on a cross and even rose from the dead, a distinction between that and saying, and he did it for me. So in approaching non-Christians, I encourage people, proclaim the gospel first, defend it second.
That's so good.
Apologetics is very often reactionary.
That's so good, Mark. Yeah. Thanks for coming on, and we hope to have you on again. God's blessings to you out there in California.
Great. Thanks, Rod. It was a pleasure.
Next week, the reliability of the Bible with Dr. Rod Rosenblatt here on Cross Defense. Don't miss it.